It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we speak with the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High School. She's speaking in Wausau tomorrow.
First, President Obama released his nearly $4 trillion budget today. It would create tax credits and initiatives for education, childcare, paid leave, and infrastructure, and would raise taxes on the wealthy by closing loopholes.
The budget is largely at odds with the priorities of the majority Republican Congress. One place they might find common ground is on ending the across-the-board spending cuts known as sequestration. Here with us to talk about the budget is Max Ehrenfreud. He's a reporter for the Wonk blog at the Washington Post. Max, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems like there have been a lot of spoilers pretty much since the State of the Union, bits and pieces of the budget leaked out beforehand. Are there any surprises that came out today?
Well, I think the interesting news over the weekend was on the president's plan to tax the earnings of U.S. corporations overseas, which right now aren't taxed until the corporations bring them back to the United States. And as a result, that money has been accumulating abroad for many years now, and I think both parties are looking for a way to collect taxes on it. But it's a difficult issue.
It's a tough one to untangle. The Republicans in Congress have reacted negatively to a lot of what the president has had to say. How have we heard any specific reaction to that idea of trying to get taxes, as you say, on these American corporations holding money elsewhere?
Well, it's an idea that some Republican economists have supported in the past, but whether or not any Republican lawmakers in office right now will support the idea remains to be seen. But I do think that in general, yes, Republicans and Democrats want to find some way of taxing these overseas profits, which right now total somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 trillion. It's a lot of money. And so I think there's a slight possibility that there might be a compromise of some kind on this issue.
Well, looking at the big picture of the budget, where do you see the president's priorities here on the spending side of things?
The priorities on the spending side are, I would say, first in investment in infrastructure, roads, bridges, railways, and the like. That is how he proposes to use the money raised from the tax on overseas corporate profits. And the other major priority, I would say, is in education. And the president's talked about that at length, of course. He wants to make community college basically free for anyone who's qualified and interested in going, more or less. He also is hoping to help provide access to preschool for more families.
And on the revenue side, we've mentioned the overseas corporate holdings, trying to tax that. What other kind of changes do we see on the tax side of things?
Yeah, so this is very interesting. I think the one point to note is perhaps the 0.07 of a percentage point fee on liabilities held by large banks. And this is essentially a tax that would be paid by the largest banks in the country and their investors, and it penalizes banks for being big, which is of course a controversial idea, but it would raise a lot of money.
Well, the idea there being that these are the so-called too big to fail banks, knowing that if they fail, the U.S. government's going to bail them out if need be. That's the philosophy here that, okay,
yeah,
if you're going to do that, you got to pay an insurance policy in effect.
Exactly. It's like an insurance policy.
So we mentioned the overseas corporate tax. You said you saw some slight chance that the president and Congress could agree on something like that. And you also mentioned that infrastructure, people like to be able to point toward investments in roads and things like that. It's definitely a constituent service. Do you see room for compromise between a Democratic president and the Republican Congress when it comes to transportation infrastructure?
It's certainly been talked about. In fact, the President Obama himself noted when he gave an interview on NBC before the Super Bowl yesterday that many Republicans are interested in investing and repairing bridges, roads, highways, and so on. As for whether or not a compromise will occur, I just can't speculate. It's too difficult to predict. Congress right now is divided on all kinds of issues, and it's easy to see, even if there is goodwill on both sides and interest in solving these problems, it's easy to see politics on other issues getting in the way.
And with this infrastructure, is the question not so much what they want to do, they want to fix roads and things like that, but how they're going to pay for it?
Yes, I think those are both questions.
Oh, okay.
I think those are both questions. I think some Republicans and perhaps some Democrats as well feel that the Highway Trust Fund, which is the main vehicle for funding transportation at the federal level, they feel that some of that money is wasted and it's used for unnecessary projects or things that don't really help with transportation. So I think that's an issue. And then, yes, there's also the issue of how it's funded. Is there going to be an increase in the gas tax, or is there going to be some kind of tax on overseas profits, as we've discussed? I'm not sure.
One other issue that comes up in this budget that Congress will have to deal with is the idea of ending the across-the-board cuts that were part of that sequestration deal. Can you tell us where we are on that and what's being proposed in this budget?
Yeah, well, this is a complicated history because a couple of years ago, Democrats and Republicans agreed to bind themselves to this law called sequestration, and the idea was that it was going to be so unpleasant for everybody involved that they would force themselves by agreeing to it to find another compromise. And that didn't happen, and so sequestration went into effect, and the federal budget for all agencies was dramatically reduced. And the way it was supposed to work was that it would reduce the budget for both the Pentagon and the non-defense federal agencies, and Republicans would defend the defense spending, and Democrats would defend the non-defense spending, and it didn't happen, and spending for everyone was reduced. Now it does look like some Republicans are again interested in increasing the budget at the Pentagon, and if that's their goal, then they're going to have to find some kind of compromise with the president and with Democrats, because I doubt that the Democrats are going to be interested in raising the budget only for the Pentagon beyond the level of sequestration without increases in other parts of the budget as well.
Well, let's look at this budget as a political document now, not so much as a budget document. Most of it, the Republicans aren't going to pass. They might take little bits and pieces. That said, what is the president hoping to accomplish with this budget?
It's interesting. It is a very progressive budget. Well, perhaps not very progressive in the grand scheme of things, but it is more progressive than the president has been in the past. For example, we mentioned the tax on large banks. It's true that, a couple of years ago, there was an amendment in Congress that would have forced the largest banks to split up, and Democrats and the president rejected that idea at the time. Now the president is talking about imposing a tax on large banks, so that's a shift. And there's also a shift in terms of Social Security. The Obama administration had previously suggested using a different method of calculating Social Security benefits that would have been less generous to senior citizens, and that proposal has also been abandoned in this document. So, yes, it is a move to the left. It's an embrace of a more populist tone, I think, an embrace of the idea that, as Obama said during the State of the Union, the economy needs to benefit everybody, and the federal government needs to make sure that the economy is benefiting everybody. Whether or not voters will be persuaded by these ideas, I think, remains to be seen.
Max, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That's Max Ehrenfreund. He's a reporter for the Wonk blog at The Washington Post. last year was the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that ruled separate schools for white and black students to be unconstitutional.
That decision began a desegregation process that lasted years and brought the depths of American racism into the national spotlight. Black children received death threats and found mobs blocking their entrance into segregated schools. Armed troops had to forcibly desegregate campuses across the South.
One group of students at the center of that tense time in American history is known as the Little Rock Nine. They were the nine African-American students selected to desegregate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. After being prevented from entering the school by a mob and the Arkansas National Guard, President Dwight Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to Little Rock to escort them into the school. This is a report from the time outside Central High.
This is Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now from their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
We were Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas, Thelma Mothershed, Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Carlotta Walls, Melba Patillo, Minnie Jean Brown, and Gloria Ray.
The youngest of the Little Rock Nine, Carlotta Walls Lanier, is in Wausau today. She'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., and she joins us now. Carlotta, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, for a long time, you didn't write or talk much about your experience at Little Rock Central High. Why not?
That's correct. Well, I'm sure it was more about how painful the time was. I wanted to just push that into the recesses of my mind and not relive those days.
It's interesting that even today you think of them as so painful, which I'm sure that they were, but your actions there, along with the aid of your cohort there, are viewed right up there with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and Rosa Parks not getting off the bus. Does the pain still outweigh the pride?
No, I've been fortunate enough to finally get it on paper, and I have a book called A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High School. And with that, I was able to put that time, express myself more openly through this book as my memoir. So it was very cathartic for me to write the book.
Now, when most people think of the Little Rock Nine, images of the guard escorting you into school come to mind, but your journey, it started well before that. How did you decide to volunteer? How did you become one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the first African Americans to desegregate Central High in Arkansas?
Well, it really, the credit goes to my parents. The credit also goes to those black teachers that I had in elementary school and in junior high school, the community that I grew up in. I was always told that even though we were being considered second-class citizens, that we weren't, that we was just as good as the next person, that we could learn like anyone else, and in the future things were going to change, and education was the key to success. So that was my foundation, basically, that I knew that I was an equal, even though I was in a separate but equal environment.
And when you first tried to enter the school in early September of that year, you were prevented. What was that particular day like for you?
Oh, it was somewhat chaotic. The Arkansas National Guard was there to keep us out. However, we were under the impression they were there to protect the citizens of Little Rock. And I surely considered myself a citizen. My father paid taxes like everyone else, had served in World War II, had honors on the battlefield. And It was a day of reckoning. Once we got there, we discovered that the Arkansas National Guard was really there to keep us out and not to really protect us. As far as they were concerned, to protect us, we needed to go home.
At that moment, did you realize that this was going to be maybe more than you
had thought it would be in the beginning. I mean, obviously you knew this was going to be tough going in, and you knew that you would be up against some resistance. But did you realize at that point the extent of what you were going to have to find within yourself to overcome?
Well, I knew that there was a segment of people who really did not want us at the school. But I also felt that humankind would overrule some of that, and that group of people would finally probably dissipate, just move away and recognize that this was the law and they should be law-abiding citizens. And they were expressing their displeasure of us attending that particular school, but I didn't think that it would last as long as it did. I thought in a week or so that it would be over with, as far as the group that were located across the street, you know, with the name calling, with all of the derisive names, the hatefulness, the harassment, and so forth.
And when you did get to enter the school, it was, in fact, it's hard to wrap your head around any of it. We have some recordings of it, which I think give the best example, because it's even hard to describe with words what it was like. So let's listen to a little bit about that day.
Sure.
We've just got a report here on this end that the students are in. Turn the key down that way, Don. Down there. You can see from here some of the action occurring down there.
And there you were at the center of that maelstrom. What did that first day feel like once you were actually inside the building and through all of those screaming mobs?
Yeah, that was September 23rd. We didn't stay the full day. And to be honest with you, I did not see that. We had, or hear that. We had entered the school in a side door, and what you heard was someone reporting that we were inside. See, that was probably, you know, 9 o'clock that day. And I was in my third class by that time when the mob was just upset with the fact that we were inside the school. We did not stay that full day. That is when the police had to move us out of the school, and because the 17 policemen that were assigned by the mayor to, you know, protect the property and the people there at the school could not hold back over 1,000 people there.
So you were aware, even while you were in those first classes of the day, you were aware that this was going on outside?
No, I was aware that the mob was there. I was not aware of all of... I was not aware of students jumping out of windows, leaving the school, that sort of thing. It was not until the news in the afternoon that I saw all of that on television.
Well, take us inside the school where you were. What was it like for you on that first day?
On that first, well, that's the first day that we got in, and on September 23rd. So, because September 4th was our first day, we never got past the National Guard. September 23rd, we were in, but we were taken out by noon. I went to my classes and was assigned a seat and so forth, and I heard some, you know, nasty remarks and that sort of thing, but that was about it. So our first full day was September 25th, and that was with the 101st Airborne.
Mm. You know, high school today can be miserable enough.
Right.
Cliques and bullying without all of the added racially motivated attacks that you were going through, both
right.
inside to a certain extent and outside the school. Mm-hmm. How did you cope and handle that from day to day?
Well, I stayed above it is what I did. I refused to bring myself down to that level of ignorance. I considered them those that did not agree with me being there. They had been influenced by some of adults and parents and so forth. They had been brought up in a segregated society. They had considered themselves privileged, and that I was invading their space. Nine of us were invading their school. I considered that rather on the ignorant side, to be honest with you. And I stayed above it mentally. That's how I got through it each day. The people spitting on you, throwing rocks at you, walking on the backs of your heels, in the hallways, all of those sort of things.
Well, we're speaking right now with Carlotta Wells Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's also the author of the book, A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Carlotta about what it was like to go through this experience? Do you remember this era, the desegregation times in the 50s and 60s? Where were you? Were you involved somehow? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Carlotta Wells Lanier, Carlotta Walls Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's in Wausau today, and she'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember desegregation in the 50s and 60s, watching it on TV, maybe being involved in it at the time? Do you feel like the country's come a long way since then, or is there still a lot of work to do when it comes to segregated neighborhoods or schools? And do you have a question for Carlotta Walls Lanier? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. Anne is joining us from the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Carlotta. I just want to say thank you for everything you've done and gone through. And my question for you is, at any point did any of your fellow students or teachers or anyone in the community ever apologize for their actions or try and make amends with you later?
In the late 80s, the nine of us were, actually it was seven out of the nine, was on Oprah Winfrey's show. And Oprah has a way of finding some of those people. And they were also a part of the show, which was a surprise to us. And there was one in particular, one man in particular, that asked for forgiveness and wanted to come up and give us a hug, and which we gladly received.
What about doing...
I've had a couple of others that, you know, via email or what have you, to reach out. But as far as complete apologizing, I think that the one that was on Oprah's show was the one that I can say definitely asked for an apology.
What about during your days at Little Rock Central High? Did any of the white teacher students reach out to you then, even in small ways?
Yes. You know, it was a reflection of our society to have a group of people who I think kids that and teachers that wanted to be friends, be friendlier. However, some were afraid as well to be harassed and bullied by those that were making it very miserable for us. There was a group that of teachers and students who wish we weren't there, period, and agreed with some of the segregationists. And then there was that silent majority, too, that just kept looking straight and not offering any assistance one way or another.
What you went through is so unfathomable to many of us who will never have to do that, or who piggyback on your acts of bravery then. Is it true what people say, that if you go through a trial by fire like that, that you do emerge stronger, or was there a price to be paid too?
Yeah, you come out I think overall you do. You come out stronger. And I agree, too, that it is a price that you pay. Our parents paid a price. A number of them lost their jobs. So, but at the same time, if you ask me, was it worth it? I would have to say, yes, it was worth it, because we were upholding the law of the land, also the Constitution. We knew we had a right to be there.
We'll go back to the callers now. We've got Nicole joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Nicole, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say thank you for this opportunity to engage in conversation with you. And I'm really curious, given your historical perspective and experience, can you talk a little bit about what you see in today's society in terms of racial injustice and kind of speak to that, given this wisdom that you have and experience from the past?
Well, I still see that there are unfounded fears of people who are different than you. I still see people who are closed-minded. I also see those who are more open-minded. I have hope that this younger generation will move in a stronger and more positive way than what I experienced. Unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. As I have said to some high school students that I have spoken to, I was moved by Emmett Till's murder. And today, kids, and still remember it, and remember it well. And our young people today will not forget a Trayvon Martin or a Mike Brown. Because basically it's some of the same things that are going on. So, however, we have a justice system that has improved, and it needs more improvement as far as that goes, but those are the sort of things that I think about in today's society.
Well, last year was the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision that ruled separate but equal schooling unconstitutional.
Yes.
And today, reports from UCLA and ProPublica show that schools are resegregating. Now,
yes.
as one of the women on the front lines of desegregation in 1957 and onward, what do you make of that?
Well, I see that as it relates to all the other areas of our society. The resegregation is really about economics is attached to that. People are resegregating or in neighborhoods and so forth because they can't afford whatever area they might want to be in. Why can't they afford the homes or the neighborhoods that they want to be in? Because they don't have the jobs that can afford that. Why is it that they don't have the jobs? Because they're not getting the best education available. Our educational system is broken in many places here in the United States. So we are not number one in the world anymore in educating our children. And I'm despondent over that piece. We are blaming other groups of people who are coming to the United States for taking certain jobs. Well, they're taking them because they are prepared to take them. They are going to universities and learning what's necessary to do what we need. We are not using education as a number one priority in our country anymore, and we need to get back to that.
Now, here in Wisconsin, there are many African Americans and whites living in highly segregated areas who may go a long time, maybe a day, maybe more, without interacting with people who don't look like them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. What's your advice to people who aren't used to living their lives with people who don't look like them?
Well, they need to open their minds and hearts and also, take it as a challenge to understand and learn about someone else who does not look like you. Understand their culture. Understand their ethnic background. Understand their language. Not use that as a negative, but use it as a learning tool to understand more about them. Be a part of more dialogue, open dialogue, not so much to be in a confrontational way, but to be open and to learn more about someone else. We can agree to disagree, but in a way that we are learning from each other.
I understand you've got two children now. They have the opportunity to live the rest of the story about civil rights and racial equality in America. What do you want them and others to take away from your story about what you and the rest of the Little Rock Nine did?
Well, I want them to understand how this country was built, whose shoulders they're standing on. We are all standing on various shoulders. And with that, we should take it to the next level of enjoying the American way and all of the things that we have here in our country. I want my kids to be able to do the type of work that they want to do, to be able to buy in any neighborhood that they want. I want them to be competitive in this global society that we live in, and to learn from other people. So I encourage not only my kids, but all other kids that I speak to get all that they can possibly get, because, you know, you can learn as much as we are capable of learning all that we can. And, you know, that is something that no one can take away from you. That piece that you learn in the various schools and educational environments that you're involved in.
Carlotta, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
We've been speaking with Carlotta Walls Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's also the author of A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High. And she's in Wausau today. She'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30 p.m.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. 4 years ago, the nonprofit Wild Instincts Rehabilitation Center near Rhinelander opened their doors to treat sick, injured, and orphaned wildlife. Nancy Camden was there last fall, shortly before 15 orphaned bears were released back into the wild.
You can see a few of the bears over there that are moving around in the cage. We'll just basically put the food in, then we'll back off.
With our altering our environment, we've done some very bad things to the animals. A lot of it is human caused, so since we broke it, we should try to fix it. My name is Mark Naniot, and my wife and I founded Wild Instincts. I have a bachelor's degree in biology. I've been doing wildlife rehab professionally for over 25 years. They were orphan cubs. We had two mothers that were illegally shot, two that were hit by cars. We had one mother, unfortunately, climb up a utility pole and got electrocuted, so we ended up with 15 this year. We had 1 year where we released five in one group. They all had radio collars on. One denned up about 80 yards from the release site, and another one went 120 miles in 10 days. Every day you never know what's going to happen, what new animals are going to come in, what animals are going to need critical care. And the good part is it's only 7 days a week, so it's not so bad. During the peak of the summer, I think at one point we had over 140. In an average year, we usually deal with pretty close to 100 different species. We're pretty much the only center in the state that does every animal that's allowed to by state and federal regulation, from hummingbirds to eagles and mice to bears and everything in between. We do have volunteers. Matter of fact, I'm a volunteer. We have no paid staff at Wild Instincts. The closest is our interns. They get paid a stipend of $75 a week.
I'm Tawny Leiby, and I'm the fall intern. Preparing some food for our isolation eagle in there, so we have bullheads and venison that we give them.
We're very big on nutrition. We don't feed any processed food at all to the animals. We want to make sure their diet is very good and nutritious and as natural as we can get. Our goal is to keep the animals as wild as possible, very minimum contact. The bald eagle, we did have to initially do subcutaneous injections. We started out with tube feeding and then eventually got to the point where we could tweezer feed it. Now it just started eating on its own. What's that? Got lice in your head?
Yeah, I got a little bird lice today.
You have to excuse us if we seem like we're a little tired, because we had a loon that had a fish hook, so we went out on the lake last night to try to capture it. So we had about 3 hours of sleep last night. We see a lot of cases of lead poisoning with loons and eagles. Oftentimes they pick up this lead shot. It's highly, highly toxic. So when they start getting sick, of course, they're easy prey for an eagle. We have 9 eagles outside in our flight cage right now. Good morning, Wild Instincts. And is it someplace I can just walk right up to, or? All right, Tawny, you ready to go rescue a beaver? I guess you can be happy it doesn't smell like skunk in here anymore. A call from the sheriff's department a few weeks back and had a skunk with a peanut butter jar stuck on his head. I'm looking for a beaver.
I happen to have one.
Well, that's perfect. There can be a lot of heartbreak to a lot of animals that come in really rough shape and they're too badly damaged or injured or diseased and you can't fix it. The national average is about a 50% success rate.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk more about animal rescue in Wisconsin is Gail Viney. She's Public Relations Coordinator for the Dane County Humane Society. The society operates the Four Lakes Wildlife Center. Gail, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So suppose just an everyday person, say me, is out there, encounters injured or ill wildlife of some sort. What do we do?
Well, the most important thing and what we're trying to really help people be aware of is that we want to help give you advice. And a lot of times, well-intentioned community members see an orphaned or injured wild animal and they think, okay, I need to help this animal. I need to take it right away and take it somewhere. More often than not, it's actually best to leave that animal where it is. Maybe the mother has just gone off to get food for the animal, or there's something going on. So what we want you to do is call our center first so that we can help give you some instruction on what the situation really needs for your help. And maybe that is having you safely capture the wild animal and bring them to us, but it might be leaving them there too.
So if there is an animal, maybe we check back and see, yes, it's wounded and it's still in this position, it hasn't been moved by a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you come out and sort of, so to speak, make house calls and scoop up and get the animal?
Right. We definitely can see if that's what's needed. More often than not, if it's a smaller animal and you feel that you can safely capture the animal, we definitely recommend wearing gloves. Sometimes even being able to use a laundry basket tipped over, you can help kind of confine the animal and safely bring it in. But if you don't feel that that is appropriate, if it is a larger raptor or an owl, something that's injured and you're worried about your safety and the animal's safety, then we really suggest you call us, and we have very experienced volunteers that will come out and either help rescue the animal. Also, we work very closely with the animal control officers. That's a city function, so not part of the Humane Society, but we work closely with them, and they will help come out and get the animal and bring them to us as well.
You know, are there certain animals where just the general guideline is don't try to make contact with it? It's just not safe?
Well, definitely if it is very injured, if it looks like it has some sort of a disease or illness, you want to really be cautious and not put yourself in danger. So again, that would be a great time to call us, explain what you're seeing, explain the behaviors of that animal, and we can help give you the correct next steps to make sure that you try and help the animal and also keep yourself safe.
Is this something that we can do on our own with a little guidance from you? I can remember my mom trying to put a toothpick splint on a mouse's leg before. I don't think it worked out very well, but in some cases, can you do that?
You know, I think that's where we have very great and experienced wildlife rehabilitators in this program that can help give you some advice if it's something you can do. I think more often than not, it's probably best to let an experienced wildlife person handle the animal, but what we really do need help with is people that can help be foster parents for sometimes baby squirrels that need to go somewhere and just be able to grow up a little bit more, or young baby bunnies or things like that. So sometimes there are ways that you can still help at home and and make a difference on that wild animal's life. We're actually doing a seminar, too, on how you can grow mealworms and redworms. It sounds weird, but we need those animals. We need those little critters to help feed our birds and wildlife. And so that's something that you can easily do in your basement or just as a way to help the Wildlife Center. And we're doing a seminar this Saturday, February 7th at the Humane Society for that.
And we heard in that Wisconsin Life piece, that was in Rhinelander, mm-hmm. and they had a problem with lead poisoning for some birds, some larger bird raptors, I think, up there. Is that something you see down here as well?
Yes.
In Dane County?
Ironically, we've seen a large influx of animals come in just in the beginning of this year. Typically, we see 2 to 3 instances of lead poisoning from animals, most often the larger raptors or eagles. And just the start of this year, we've already had 3 bald eagles come in with lead poisoning, 3 tundra swans, and 2 geese. So it's definitely something that we are very much aware of, and we're trying to get the word out there, talk about it, that really the importance of non-toxic ammunition could really make a big difference in helping these animals not come in with the lead poisoning issues.
Can you give us some examples, besides some of the raptors and things you just mentioned, of the animals that you have helped over the years, maybe right now?
Yeah, it's amazing. This wildlife program has been incredible. It started in 2002, and the numbers have continued to grow, I think, when people learn about our services. But we've seen everything from eagles, swans, we've had fox, possum, badgers, pelicans, snowy eagles, snowy owls, excuse me, everything even smaller, too. We have a lot of smaller turtles that come in from being hit when they're crossing the road. And even right now, we're currently caring for a couple salamanders. We have a least weasel, which is one of, I think, the smallest mammal. There's something unique about the least weasel, but it's a very teeny little thing that we're helping. So it's from big to small. We've seen so many different animals.
Can people from the public come in and get training and volunteer to help with this effort?
Yes, absolutely. This program is almost 100% volunteer run. So we really do need the support of the community. And we're constantly doing new training sessions. We get very busy in the spring and summer. That's when our numbers really, we have an influx of animals. So that would be the best time for people to start coming out within maybe the months of March and learning so that you're ready to help the influx of animals. But absolutely, we could not run without our volunteers, so we appreciate anyone that's interested.
Obviously, it's got to be really rewarding when you nurse an animal back to mm-hmm. health and you get to release it back into the wild again. Do you have any stories of recently released animals who've made it?
We had a really amazing red-tailed hawk that came in with an injured wing, and with just the time spent with us and the rehab we were able to do, we work really hard to release the animal back to where they were found. We want to make sure that they go back into their natural habitat. If they maybe had a mate or family, we want to try and help reunite those animals. So it's always neat to be able to be a part of that release, and a lot of times some of the wildlife volunteers get to go out and actually be there to help release the animals, and it's a really unique part of being a volunteer.
You say peak season is a little later in the year. How many animals might you have in various stages of rehabilitation at one time?
Well, in a year, we see about 3,000 wild animals come through our doors. So we definitely are starting to see many. I think just from the start of the new year, we've already seen 400, 500 animals. So we're on track to continue to see that high number of 3,000.
Well, Gail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all you do.
We've been speaking with Gail Viney, Public Relations Coordinator for the Dane County Humane Society.